Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
I feel the need for speed.
There it is.
I had to do it at once.
Chris Speed.
Yes, Chris Speed.
Yeah, no.
You've seen this band, Nate, many, many years ago when Ars Nova Workshop presented them, gosh, at the beginning of the Ars Nova Workshop itself.
This is true. Shout out to our friend Mark Christman, the founder and fearless leader of the Ars Nova Workshop. So Mark and I go back to the mid to late 90s, and we became friends at where else? A record store.
There you go.
Mark was, at that time, working behind the counter at Classical Choice, later known as CD Choice. I was a frequent patron, and we just struck up a conversation, and then he started presenting music. And initially, he sort of took over somebody else's fledgling operation, and then he decided he wanted to start his own organization. And I had been playing some gigs around town here in Philly, and one of them was at a place called Plays and Players. And I didn't know about it before then. And I mentioned to Mark, hey, there's a spot that you might want to look at for presenting shows. Long story short, that is where he did, in fact, present the first Ars Nova Workshop show in March of 2000. Chris Speed's Yeah, No.
Has this band been in continuous operation for all these years?
No.
Okay.
It was a steady concern from 30 years ago through the mid-2000s, I think. It was really going in the late 90s and around the turn of the century. And so in March of 2000, when they played here, they were at the height of their powers, but they still had further to go. So we should say this is a band with Chris Speed on tenor saxophone and clarinet, Kung Vu on trumpet, Scully Sverrison on electric bass, and Jim Black on drums. And this one's kind of personal for me, not just because of the Ars Nova history, but also I moved to New York in 1998. And at that time, Chris Speed and Jim Black were playing all the time with a band called Tim Burns' Blood Count. And I went and saw this band at every possible opportunity. It was so exciting. And one thing that was exciting was this feeling that Tim Byrne, who had been around the block a few times and had a real heavy reputation, he had built a band around this rapport between these two guys who were really fresh on the scene, both from Seattle. They had both gone to school in New England, and now here they were, like, doing something really ferocious and pushing the envelope. And they're a few years older than me, but I identified with what they were bringing. And I thought, man, how exciting that this cohort is making some noise. But Yeah, No was a more pure manifestation of that, because it really was a peer group.
Talk to me about Scully Sverrison, because the first time I heard him, I can't remember which Winter and Winter record it was, but I said, what is this?
He's a virtuoso. Truly amazing instrumentalist, and also a kind of like a poet of atmosphere. He is Icelandic. I think he's from Reykjavik. That is where he lives now. And he plays the electric bass in a way that is somehow simultaneously like really sort of technical and virtuosic, but also very calm and meditative. He strikes that magic balance. In this band, he functions both as a bass player and then also as a kind of guitarist, This is a band that's very influenced by the sound of indie rock, noise rock, shoegaze, It's a real sort of Gen X band. And Scully, who also has worked extensively with Laurie Anderson, he worked for a small portion of time with Lou Reed, and just a ton of other people. He's just the perfect gravitational center. Jim Black, meanwhile, is just this incredible cyclonic force of percussion. So powerful, frenetic, unpredictable, wild. It was really a treat to see this band again. I wish I could convey to anyone listening, like the smiles on the faces of these guys, like in between every song, like after the first song, Kung said something like, you know, I wish you knew how happy we are. You know, it was really, really cool to see.
What's the critical take on this after that long of dormancy? And also after you saw them at the beginning, is the magic still there? Is it a different kind of magic?
The magic is absolutely still there, and they access it. It doesn't feel like trying to conjure up some old magic. It's like they just plug back in, and the chemistry just fires right back up. I think that they are all better and deeper musicians now than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I think unmistakably. But there is a kind of throwdown youthful energy in this band. And I asked them a little bit about that. What is it like to sort of go there again? And in somewhat amusing fashion, they talk about that a bit. They've got their fastball, you know, like there's no problem there. But, you know, but they're also like approaching it from a different perspective now, you know, as I suppose I am as a listener. But it is a group language that has its own syntax and dialect and everything. And it has an integrity. I think they carved out a space for themselves and have had an influence now. There's a lot to say just in praise of Chris Pizziano. And, you know, I should stop myself before I go too far with it, because you'll hear me engaging with Chris and Jim on stage at Solar Myth and drawing out some of why I think this band is special.
Well, in your words, let's go there. Your conversation with the members of Yeah, No.
Hey guys, welcome to The Late Set from WRTI, and welcome back to Philadelphia.
Right on, yeah.
Thank you. A lot of history here.
A lot of history. I've been, as soon as I learned about this, and I think it was just like a casual comment from Mark Christman, he's like, this is happening, because obviously there is really notable history with this band and this organization. Yeah No played the very first Ars Nova Workshop show at Plays and Players in March of 2000, and I was there.
You did a preview for it.
I did.
Because you were writing for a Philly newspaper then.
For the Philadelphia City Paper.
Right.
So that's significant for this organization, and look how far we've come. We're here at Solar Myth. Ars Nova has done amazing things, and so have both of you and everyone in this band. So I'm just really excited to be here at this next juncture in sort of everyone's history.
I'm glad you're excited, because I've been very excited to get to play with these guys again as well. Yeah. So yeah.
Let's begin by actually going back to that moment. I was able to find, thanks to the good folks at Songlines Records, which, you know, kept a record of this. In that preview, I guess, that I wrote for the City Paper, you, at that point, Yeah No had an album out called Deviantics, the second album.
Okay.
And then there was also an album out from Pechora, which was the other working band you had.
Yep.
Featuring 3/4 of Yeah No. And so I'm going to read you a sentence or two from the thing that I wrote. And we'll just kind of, we can make fun of my prose and then take it from there. What these musicians have crafted is rapidly developing into an oeuvre. Both of these recent releases showcase their wide range of influences, near telepathic interplay, and two distinctive but overlapping identities. So, I think it holds up. But let's talk about that moment. So this is like 1999 into 2000, where you guys were with this band and with this concept, and then we'll catch us up a bit.
Pechora and Yeah No, and also later Jim's band, Alas No Axis, were all formed by me, Jim, and Schooley, who's not here with us right now. He's wisely getting something to eat with Kong. But so all those projects that we were doing together, I think Yano might have been the first one. And each one was sort of direction and stuff that we were really interested in and working on. And Yano was maybe my baby. I was doing most of the composing and organizing. And then Pechora was more of a collective, and then Jim's band, of course, was his music. But I think we had so many interests, but we wanted to keep each band clearly unique and singular so that there wasn't any sort of confusion. Obviously, there was confusion enough with three of us being in different bands, same guys. Which band is it? Yeah, just to what you said. Sorry, I wasn't having a stroke there. What you were saying as far as, like, you know, developing our own sort of ideas, that was very much on our mind, and just to be, you know, very clear about what we were doing and doing it, you know, the best we could and making it as clear as possible.
Think about what was happening on the scene at that time. So the band formed, was it in 1996, thereabouts?
Yes.
Yeah. Five, six, yeah.
So 30 years ago. And you guys were coming out of jazz training and then not so traditional training. And at that point, I also knew the two of you as members of Tim Burns' Blood Count.
Right.
And Tim was, you know, as he is now, a powerful kind of co-signer of younger talent.
Yep.
And then just, like, you know, a fiercely independent voice, you know, someone you could look to and be like, oh, you could do it that way, you know? And so when I think about Yeah No, there was something that struck me right away as, like, very distinctly of your generation, which also happens to be mine, you know? You guys had studied and absorbed so much from the jazz language and literature, but you were also, you know, really into David Lynch and, like, shoegaze music and, you know, also the Eastern European and Balkan music that you were playing in that other band. You know, there was just so much happening. It felt very, like, very, like, along the edge, you know? Like, it was just like, we are just pushing this. Is that how it felt to you at that time?
Can I add one more thing and then you go? I just have to say that obviously Tim was very influential. He's an icon, and Jim and I are forever, you know, grateful for getting to work with him and tour the world and be in one of the coolest bands, you know, in the early 90s then. But Jim and I's interest in more radical things was we were working on that before with a band called Human Feel, which was our band with Andrew and Kurt, Andrew D'Angelo and Kurt Rosenwinkel. And that's where we were really sort of separating ourselves from maybe more sort of traditional jazz ideas and really trying to discover a way to sort of write our own music and play in a way that wasn't, you know, so immediately identifiable as, you know, jazz music.
Mention Human Feel as well, because Tim Burns knew he had hired two young people in his band that already had a band.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he told me once, he goes, I was intimidated by you guys because we already had our way of playing. We had a language together. We had already been writing songs, improv structures, all those things. And Tim's music was a deep dive into playing. If anything, I mean, that was the main thing about Blood Count, was, like, we were improvising mainly.
Right.
And dealing with Tim's beautiful written material. But at that time, I think for our generation, at that point, I have to think back to Frizzell when we were in school, he released Before We Were Born on Nonesuch, back when they were really making really adventurous albums. And that was sort of, in a way, for me, sort of got together the past with, like, how do you square Coltrane and Hendrix?
Right.
How do you square noise, improv, singing, song structure? That's all on that album. That's a fantastic listen if you don't know it, Before We Were Born. I play that for students now, and they can't believe that's what was happening in 85.
Right, right. So, and probably they're like, wait, this is Bill Frisell?
Exactly.
Is that guy?
Every single time. And you've got Arto Lindsay singing Steady Girl on there, and fantastic. So for us, then, how do we square our times? And I think we were doing this between Pechora, Yeah, No. The first Yeah, No album was an improv that Chris transcribed. We had improvised together. He had transcribed the hot bits and then wrote songs based upon that. So
yeah.
We're using our own language to make a new sort of language for us, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Pechora was an extension of, here's this influence from the Balkans that Chris was very passionate about. Who's down to learn these rhythms that we have no idea how to play? Oh, me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a big, we added Schooley after we had the trio with Brad Shepik and Chris, and Schooley just dropped right in because he's a genius, playing with Alan Holdsworth and Blonde Redhead
right.
at that time. And then if you go to Alas, when Winter asked me to make an album, the first thing I thought was like, great, I'm on a major label. I'll call Bill Frisell, my hero, and I'll make an album. And I don't even think that message ever got to Bill. I'm sure his management shut it down. At that time, that was not really the thing to do. So I made a list of people like, who do you want to play with? I'm like, who can do this? Who's got an open enough mind that understands where I'm coming from?
Yeah.
So I'm like, Chris, Schooley, and then Hilmar Jensen, who was our roommate for a time in New York. I was like, I miss playing with Hilmar, so I'm going to make this band with these three.
Yeah.
So they share, the three of us, not, I would say not a big plan, but the three of us, and you have to add Kung as well, we love all this music. How can we express it? How can we figure out how to do it? And so writing songs, singable melodies, things like that, this is what we were taking up.
Yeah.
Before 2000.
I think of a title from your first album, Merge, and it feels like whatever that represents, confluence, convergence, like coming together, like it's social as well as musical, right? And that has carried through. I mean, I think if you listen to all of the releases from all of these bands during that early 2000s period, it's very clear that this is like, it's this changeable yet consistent organism, you know, and like it can assume different forms based on who's writing the tunes, what the sort of intention is, but it's all so strong. So that sort of leads me to this.
Nice to hear. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, no. It leads me to this next idea that I had, which was imagining the circumstances around this reunion. I almost picture it like a certain kind of heist movie where it's a bunch of guys who used to do jobs together and they've been scattered and like one of them's working.
That's better than a bucket list movie.
is that what it's like? You know,
one more for the old times.
Jim, you're in Berlin.
No, I mean, I live in Switzerland.
Oh, you're in Switzerland. All right. You're in Switzerland. Kung is up in the Pacific Northwest. Chris, you're in LA now, right? And is Schooley in...
He's in Reykjavik.
He's in Reykjavik. Yeah. So you guys are like off leading your respectable lives. And now we've got one more big heist to pull off.
Yeah, hopefully it's not just one. I mean, I've been so excited to get this band back together. And
the older you get, the more you sort of appreciate the good stuff and good friends and musicians that have been with you from the beginning. And I'm trying not to get too nostalgic or too sort of, you know, weepy, but just staying, you know, focused on, like, you know, booking the tour and getting them over here and buying the flights early enough where I don't go bankrupt and, you know, that kind of stuff. But really, it's been so rejuvenating for me, and it's taught me so much about just the musical process and how it's sort of ageless. Like, because I've been writing some new music for the last, you know, few months for these guys, and I feel like I was transported back to the 90s. I mean, I was just like, you know, then checking out music I was listening to back then and realizing like I'm kind of writing the same stuff that I've wrote for them back then. And it was just, it's been really fun and a great learning experience. And also like, oh my God, I just feel like I'm in my 20s again. But, you know, just that thing of trying to create stuff, the 30 years, you know, playing that I have now, and just to be like so clear about what's been so good for me about it, and to be in this position where you don't have the same maybe angst as you did in your 20s has been really delightful. I mean, obviously, you know, there's certain things you do when you're young that are just so great and energetic, but I'm just focused on like the good feeling of hearing Kung's trumpet and Schooley's beautiful bass and Jim's, you know, crazy. You know, I feel very fortunate that I'm able to sort of honor what I was doing back then and keep it moving forward. And hopefully, you know, there'll be a new chapter, you know.
That's really exciting. You know, I heard a little bit of Soundcheck and it reminded me of something. I had the great fortune when I was writing about music for the New York Times.
Oh, missed you there, by the way.
All right.
We miss you.
I was the person who reviewed The Police at Madison Square Garden twice at the beginning of their reunion, the worldwide reunion tour, and at the end, the very last show. It was really something to understand like how much life these guys had lived since they broke up in the mid 80s and how much other music they had made. And yet when the three of them were playing together, they almost couldn't help themselves. It was just like, this is that thing. Like, it's like nobody else can do this thing. It's a very specific chemistry, you know. And even so, just hearing the few minutes of Soundcheck, I was like, oh, it was like meeting a friend that I hadn't seen in a while.
Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
And when you meet a friend you haven't seen in a while, you're not aware of how much time has passed.
Right.
You just pick up where you left off, right? That's the beauty of this as well. This band is 30 years old, but I wouldn't know what that really means.
Yeah.
We started playing, it's like no time has passed. Pechora got back together, the band, and we made a new album that'll be out sometime soon.
Oh, great.
That was like a huge hiatus. Human Field took two huge breaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the music business, we know it's hard to keep things going consistently all the time. It just... 20 years was too much of a break, but I'm just, yeah.
Well, and life is too much to deal with sometimes.
Yeah,
well, right. Everything. I mean, this is a lifetime, right? 30 years, what happens? It's one thing from 0 to 30, 30 to 60 is another ride,
yeah.
As most of you would attest to. I'm hoping 60 to 90 is going to be even more bizarre. But along the way, the music is a marker, and the music is home, and the music with your friends and new friends, and you still get back together, and let's continue the conversation, you know?
All of you have, at this point, had a lot of contact with emerging musicians. Like you all teach. Kung is like, he's running a music department at University of Washington. But you all have individual, you know, relationships with young musicians. And then you also teach in classrooms. And so I wanted to ask about your understanding of, you know, where the conversation is now versus where it was when you were in your 20s. Like, I think of this band as really influential in a kind of stealthy way in terms of permission structures, you know? It's like, oh, we can bring the like super literacy of like John Coltrane and, you know, like all of the most elevated kind of jazz language with post-punk intensity, with, you know, like complex compositional form with, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like, you know, obviously this isn't the only band to do that, but you guys were so consistent. And what felt really remarkable to me in the late 90s and early 2000s now is kind of lingua franca. You know what I mean? So can you talk about that a little bit?
Any 25-year-old has no idea what it was like to live in the slow food era. And I do mean that because they have no idea what it's like to live in a world where there wasn't 20 billion tracks to listen to, mm-hmm. right? We're from everything came down one pipe. There were 10 releases that month around what we were into. We listened to all 10. Let's get the next 10 the next month. So we have a different learning structure, a different learning system of learning. When you're talking with young people now, they can grab from anywhere at any time. And I think we're valuable at our age because we can help guide them. Like, here's the good stuff. Or here's stuff that really we found moving, aesthetics, landmarks, things that influenced us if they like what we do. But they're grabbing from what floats by their ears, what their friends maybe check out. So trying to encourage that old school way of like, play music for your friends. And, you know, that's how I started even getting into this music was my friend was playing me stuff like, don't listen to that. Listen to that. You know, I could have gone in any direction musically, but now I think more than ever, people are looking for identity. And we're trying to encourage, at least in teaching from what I've seen, look, there's no scene to join. There's no gig to get. What do you want? Why do you even need to make a sound? So let's go there as fast as we can. And it's a life's work still. You can't fast forward, but to help them be relevant as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's hard when I'm with students. I mean, you're a writer, so you maybe look at things historically. I don't look at what I've done. We just do what we do. And so when I'm with students, I'm not like, oh, here's what I did in 1995. And I'm more like, let's check out some more net stuff that they are not maybe getting in a music school or if we improvise, you know, just improvise freely. But I don't think about my own development so much, you know, at this point. Maybe that's normal for artists. We just kind of do what we do and then people make sense of it later somehow. But just having you say that, I'm definitely thinking like there was definitely a process. And when we were younger, and it was definitely about music, you know, it was definitely about playing together. It was definitely about listening to so much music that we could and falling in love with so many things. And then like the hard work of writing stuff and writing a song or coming up with some stuff and then actually following through and making it happen either by, you know, jamming or getting gigs or tour, anything where it was just, you know, you could put it into practice and make it work. And when I am with students, you know, I'm just like, you got to play as much as you can, you know, mm-hmm. play with your friends and figure it out what it is that, you know, you want to do by playing rather than like sort of thinking about, I mean, it's important to sort of, you know, have ideas and stuff, but I think just the physical act of playing is so necessary, especially for young musicians. And I know it's hard, you know, because, well, like Jim was saying, there's not as many opportunities mm-hmm. to do that, especially outside of a school situation.
There's also one thing that did not exist for any of us in that original time was social media and the pressure to sort of have everything out there. You guys did a lot of shedding individually and collectively that was not for public consumption, you know? And that strikes me as like really crucial in terms of, you know, because by the time people were hearing you as a band, the thing was already established. Your connection, your hookup, all of the kind of intuition that you shared was really strong and you had to get there, you know?
Again, I don't look at it like that. I just remember just learning stuff and just struggling through stuff and trying to figure it out. And at that age, so much is going on, just like, but yeah, it was a lot of work, a lot of practicing and hanging out and doing stuff that I look back and laugh at or whatever. But yeah, it made us who we are, whatever we did. Mm-hmm. So you have to honor it somehow.
I'm a full-time, part-time professor in Switzerland, meaning I do the workload of a full-time professor, but half-time. So it's pretty intense.
Yeah,
I'm dealing with social media issues constantly. I'm thinking of a band like Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, Carla Kilstedt.
Yeah.
She told me that they rehearsed underground for an entire year before dropping that project live. So when it dropped, it was like a bomb going off.
Yeah.
And it worked. This is before the internet, right at the birth of it. So that worked. My partner, she's younger than me. She's like, it's not about the end result anymore. No one cares. It's just, they just want to see the process, which to me is horrifying. but when I see a young friend of mine posting videos of himself practicing, and I'm stealing all this stuff for free. I mean, what is Instagram? It's to sell yourself. It's to sell things. It's selling things. So I'm like taking the lessons off the kid. Like, you don't know what you're doing. You're giving away this stuff for free before you try to sell it when you're older. Okay, I don't know what this is. I would rather see the end result personally. That's how I'm wired. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see your process. I think it's kind of embarrassing in a way. But when I talk to younger people, they're like, well, what other way can we be found?
Right.
You know, there's no print media. There's no one looking out for you anymore. You got to advertise yourself. So I get it.
Yeah.
And I'm beyond joyful to try and not engage with this so much unless it's contractually necessary, which it is.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of it, but don't let it replace the art form. Mm-hmm. You can't. And that we could talk for hours about this, especially as AI gets closer and closer to the music industry, business. It's just going to cancel out so much stuff. So it will be about live performance, human beings, and what's the sound you actually make.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm kind of cool because it's what I do.
Mm-hmm. You built a certain amount of momentum when things were different. And so now it's kind of, I think about this a lot, you know, for myself. I mean, we mentioned the Philadelphia City Paper. I don't know how else I would have gotten started if not for an alt weekly existing that people read, you know? And it was like, I needed to learn a lot of things from people who could teach me. And that was the pipeline, you know?
And people were curious.
Right.
They had curiosity.
It's just about the foundations constantly shifting under our feet, right?
Yeah, daily at this point.
Yeah. Right. Now, the flip side of that is hope for the future. And I think of two examples. You know, one, and this is a while ago now, but when I went out to Seattle to write a piece about jazz education for the Times, it's more than 10 years ago now, but it was shortly after Kung had started there. And there was all this energy and there were all these young musicians who were like, we got Kung Fu. Like, yeah, this is, you know, like this is where it's happening. And they were so passionate. And we've now seen, you know, really amazing musicians come out of that program and through that mentorship. And then the other example I have is last fall when I was at the Berlin Jazz Festival, Jazz Fest Berlin, and I saw a big band led by Felix Henkelhausen.
Is that a student? Yeah.
Your student. And I remember sitting there and this band was, and Felix is, he's in his 20s, right?
Just turned 30.
And I was sitting there like, man, this band is so, they're doing such advanced things. And it's, and I was like, what does this remind me of? And I was like, it kind of reminds me of Jim Black, the way that things are organized, you know, the way that a very specific kind of volatility built into the arrangements. And then I was like, oh, he's one of your students. So I just wanted to ask about how you guys feel about sort of the state of the music, you know, and I'm baiting you to say there's a lot of exciting stuff going on, but if you feel like saying something else, please do.
I love the way you say state of the music, as if it's the thing
That
we can even track anymore.
Sure.
All I did was with Felix was with this ensemble. I only taught half a year in Berlin at this mm-hmm. time. And all I did was show him Peter Evans, how he was writing rhythmically. And you see the lights go off.
Yeah.
You see him tapping the rhythms and clapping the rhythms that I didn't even know. I'm just passing information on. So the seed of curiosity, he takes that information and generates his own world, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no lack of this. How it's going to come out, a lot of people are trying a lot of different things. And the beauty, one of the nice things about the internet, is that when Kim Cass, fantastic bass player, who works as a gardener at Brooklyn Botanical Garden and has a family, a child, and writes the most insane music for bass electronics, the minute he drops an album, all I have to do is write him. I have the scores in my hand and off they go to my kids. Or Matt Mitchell releases something new and Felix already has the scores. Mm. So this is different than the 80s where you had to fly across the Atlantic and spend 10 years in a city to meet people where you can, if anything turns you on, write them. Talk. And the communication between scenes now, you talk about state of the music, this is hatching something amazing.
Yeah.
What you're hearing from Felix is the modern version of moving to New York and sitting around for 10 years or 20, 15 years. You just do it through the internet now. Sound turns you on. The skills are there. The border thing, I have to go to New York and make it there to make great music is completely, New York will always have fantastic music. That's not it, but you don't have to go there.
Mm-hmm.
You will hatch and grow all over the planet now. So the state of the art is fantastic. And it's in a way that it's not even related to us, even if we're the instigators or help generate more musicians. It's not our music. When I hear my students do their recitals after 3 years, it's like, that's your music. That's not my music. Yeah. That's fantastic. And you feel old when you're hearing this, like, okay, that's new music. Damn it. It might not have any relation to what we do, but we're getting them to do their thing. And everybody has a thing that has to be nurtured and grown and developed.
Mm-hmm.
So the state of the music is super healthy. The business is another story.
Right.
And we can't really talk about that in any clear way. Touring's difficult and stuff. And I have a feeling the future will be local, but you still need curiosity. What I see is that the kids in Bern, Switzerland, where I live, support each other. It's a familial thing. They go to each other's gigs and that's the community.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to go international. They try, but Switzerland's a bubble anyway. Interesting.
Yeah. No, I think you really just diagnosed something very crucial. This combination of local, hyper-local, and like the borderlessness of our communications, right? So it's like you're kind of operating on two different frequencies all the time.
They're aware. We're all aware.
Yeah.
And that's the history of this music, right? Is to be aware. So they might not go out to all the gigs, but they're aware.
Yeah.
It's just a different way of processing information. Mm-hmm. It's a different way of learning. And every day I get asked about what I did 30 years ago. Well, not what I just released yesterday, but 30 years ago, they're asking about what I do still.
At this point, it's kind of like it lives in legend. It was a moment that continues to resonate, you know?
We're not the biggest names. We're not the most famous. We never had we didn't get the gold bars career-wise, but we have our respect. We have our artistic admiration.
Yeah.
I'm told over and over and mm-hmm. over. So you feel like you did the right thing. You stuck to your guns. And this is all, what is this except a labor of love?
Yeah. Yeah. The work says it all. Yeah. So how about a hand for Chris Speed and Jim Black? And yeah, no.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
Nate Chenin's conversation with the members of Yeah No from Solar Myth.
Wasn't that fun?
It was. It's always great when you get to a certain vintage, I guess we're sort of approaching that space in some level where you can kind of look back a little bit and make a certain assessment about your own artistic growth, your own career, how it's changed, the things that you do now and the things that they're doing now in some ways aren't the same as what they were doing when that band formed.
Right. There's a mix of like, how did this happen? And well, you know, I started out with a lot of ambition and a lot of energy, and I put one foot in front of the other, and I, you know, grabbed onto every, you know, twig I could grab, you know, and like built the house, you know. But it is very cool to engage with them, especially as they're sort of reforming in this very, very, you know, early important manifestation. You know, Josh, we headed right in. I didn't even ask what your history with this band is. Do you have one?
I don't.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't.
So you've seen all of these musicians in different bandstands and formulations.
Never saw them as one. And I guess they're going to have to keep the reunion tour going so that I can check it out eventually. I was out of town for this one.
Yeah. I didn't say this earlier, but especially because Jim now is based in Europe. He was in Berlin for some time. Now he's in Switzerland. You know, we haven't seen him in a minute.
Right.
And there was a time, you know, like a good long while where
he was ubiquitous.
He was everywhere. I saw him, you know, sometimes on a weekly basis. And I won't say I forgot how much I missed that, but it was so cool to just get that big infusion of Jim Black percussive, you know, vortex energy again. Yeah, exactly. And also Kung, you know, like Kung is an incredible player, and the chemistry that he and Chris have as a frontline is very special, I think. I think they felt it too.
Well, I know they're scattered to the four winds in some ways with Seattle and Los Angeles and Switzerland, but do you think they're going to kind of keep this going?
I think so. It felt like the sort of the beginning of a new phase for them. And I think it's really welcome, because one thing that's changed, you know, since the original incarnation of this band is what they were doing in the late 90s and early 2000s. It felt like pretty out there. You know, it was like this avant-garde yet song forward and groove forward sort of proposition. It wasn't quite of the downtown scene, and yet it was. It wasn't quite, you know, of a sort of jam band dynamic. You know, it really had this very unique space. And we now have, you know, a couple of generations of younger musicians who, you know, whether they specifically drew inspiration from Yano or not, there was a sort of available set of possibilities, you know. And I think of even a band that's just a little bit younger, like Kneebody. It's probably a stretch to talk about like the snarky puppy universe, but you know, we're talking about a general set of, you know, parameters, right?
And how a new generation approaches that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is no longer like, they no longer feel like some kind of like strange meteorite that fell out of the sky. Like there's a context for this band now. And I will be really curious to see if they resonate with listeners and fans and even musicians who are presently in their 20s and early 30s. You know, like, is that connection there to be made? I think so, but I might just be speaking as a, you know, as a straight up Gen X guy myself.
Right. Well, fascinating conversation, and thank you for sharing it.
Well, now it's time for the segment that we fondly call This I Dig.
I'll go first. I'm going to surprise you, Nate, because the thing that I dug recently was on television.
Gasp.
I know. You know I never watch TV.
Do you even have one?
I have like zero cultural references. I have no idea what's going on unless it's the Phillies.
Yeah.
Or it's music. And so I don't watch a lot of things. And so every time you dig something.
College football too.
College football too, yeah. But, you know, every time you dig something and it's some series or whatever, I just stare at you blankly. But I do that a lot anyway, so may not notice. I was recently on vacation and I went home to Louisiana. And I was really, really kind of bored at my in-laws' house. They live in Covington, Louisiana, on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain. So it's removed from New Orleans, mm-hmm. let's say. And out there in the woods on 10 acres.
At a certain point, you can't peel any more crawfish. You just...
That's it. You've got nothing left. So my wife, she connected to BritBox, one of the innumerable subscription services that we pay for,
mm-hmm.
because she and my daughter watch a lot of stuff. And we found a series called Karen Peary. Do you know about Karen Peary?
I do not. It sounds like a colleague of ours.
Could be. she could be part of the Jazz Detectives, as it were. She is a Scottish detective, a fictional character, of course. This is based on the Scottish crime novelist Val McDermid series. So she's written a few of these series. The point is, Karen Peary, P-I-R-I-E, investigates cold cases.
Is she a, you know, young, middle-aged?
She's like young and really a go-getter and a woman working in a very heavily male-dominated culture,
mm-hmm.
In the police service. Anyway, she's incredibly ambitious, and it's set in modern times. And the first series, there are only like three or four episodes for each of the two series that are available at this point. So the first series, she was investigating the murder a quarter century ago of a barmaid. And then for the second series, she investigates a kidnapping and disappearance of the daughter of a very wealthy energy magnate, as it were. And so each of these things, I'll just tell you, is very well done. The incredibly well written. The second series is almost like watching Greek tragedy.
Hmm.
And I can't even tell you all of the plot twists that happen in the course of a single episode. But it really does make you lean in and watch it. And I was taken by it. And I'm generally not taken by anything on television.
Look at you bringing in the prestige TV pick.
I know. But this is from like 2022. And then the second series, I believe, was from last year.
All right.
And they're anticipating a third series of Karen Peary. I highly recommend it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
I have a more Jacksonian pick today because I'm going to talk about a cocktail.
Okay.
So, as you recall, we recently had a day in our jazz-loving lives that was both the centennial of Miles Davis, which we've talked about on our previous episode, and a day of mourning for Sonny Rollins.
Mm.
And the convergence of those two things was, you know, it was unavoidable. It was what it was. I think we all made, you know, our peace with it. But at the end of that day, I was at home and I felt like, I want to raise a glass to both of these, you know, titans of my listening life. And in the case of Sonny Rollins, also a personal hero and something of a friend. And so I made a drink called a Gold Rush. Have you ever had a Gold Rush?
I have never had a Gold Rush.
All right. I look forward to making you one.
Is this with like Goldschlager?
No.
And Red Hots or whatever that stuff is.
Oh my God.
That's Fireball.
Goldschlager sends me back. This is a drink that was originally devised by a gentleman named TJ Siegel at the bar Milk and Honey. You might remember that.
Yes.
So he came up with this drink, and it's a variation on a whiskey sour.
I'm down with that.
But what it has is, you know, it's got bourbon, lemon juice, and simple syrup made with honey instead of sugar.
Okay.
And so the ratio is very simple. I think it's 2 ounces of bourbon and 3/4 of an ounce each of lemon juice and honey syrup. And that's it. Shake with ice, strain, serve.
No cherry mash, no nothing.
No.
All right.
The honey does a lot of work in this drink. It's really remarkable. And, you know, it's that classic lemon and honey combination. But with the bourbon, it's that perfect balance between bite and tart and sweet.
Yeah.
But because it's not a sugar sweet, it's a honey sweet, it has this kind of viscosity to it too, which is really nice. Anyway, it's an excellent cocktail, and it was a really nice way to just sit and have my feelings and thoughts about Sonny Rollins and Miles Davis. So there you go.
I think if it were legal according to the FCC, this would be a great drink to have to coat the throat.
Yes, it would, in fact, yeah.
Lemon and honey.
We should, I mean, is it illegal?
We'll find out.
All right. Next up on the late set, cheers.
Cheers. Clink, clink. The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. We are deeply, deeply grateful. Thank you. It's hosted by me, Josh Jackson, and Nate Chenin, and produced by Alex Arif. The interview was recorded at Solar Myth by Bo Gordon and presented by our friends at Ars Nova Workshop. Shout out to Mark Christman.
Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager and mixed this episode. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Our production assistants are Jacob Dodd, James McGovern, and Alana Beltran. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we've got going on here in Philly and beyond. We'll see you soon.